So I have as my intention to get through this list of the sati similes this afternoon and to be able to end the day with a short sit, so I shall endeavor not to digress. I think it's quite good to sort of have a visual image of some of these similes. It's quite helpful often rather than just the words. So sati is often portrayed as a strong post that is hammered into the ground to which six wild animals are tied. And of course the six wild animals are the censors that are intent on, you know, ranging and rampaging off into familiar territory that doesn't serve them well. So it's an image that speaks of the stability, the firmness, and the willingness to restrain aspect of sati. The next of these images is an image of a person moving through a crowded marketplace with a full bowl of oil balanced on their head, followed by someone wielding a sharp sword who is going to decapitate them if they spill the oil. So this image actually portrays the undividedness, the undivided nature of mindfulness that is firmly rooted in body awareness, that is not actually being, as a person moves through the crowded marketplace, they're actually not being distracted and diverted by the range of entertainers and fire eaters and musicians and dancers there in the crowd. They actually know how to maintain the sense of balance amidst these conditions which they simply cannot control. And the body mindfulness of the body, really stands out here as being the grounding principle of sati. The next of the similes that is used is the image, and remember, these images were drawn out of a very agricultural society in the time of the Buddha, you know, where if someone was going to plough their field, they would have a fairly rudimentary plough hooked up to an oxen, and it would depend upon the plough person maintaining the right pressure on the plough in order to till the ground to the appropriate depth in which seeds could be cultivated and then grow, and to also keep the straightness of the furrow that is being ploughed. So this actually refers to the continued clarity of direction and the appropriate effort that is being used in the cultivation of mindfulness. Too much pressure, the furrow is too deep, the seeds won't grow. Too little, the seeds will still stay on the surface of the ground. The next of the images of sati is where sati is portrayed as a surgeon using a probe to remove an arrowhead from a wound, and how the surgeon wouldn't just necessarily dive in with their scalpel, that first they would use the probe to ascertain the nature of the wound, to then decide on the appropriate response, and then to take the appropriate course of action. And it's the way that the Buddha often uses this medical metaphor of sati as a way of diagnosing the problem, being able to promote a prognosis, the nature of the wound, and then prescribe an appropriate course of healing. So it talks about mindfulness with this attitude of investigation, examining, even though that might be uncomfortable. So the you get a lot of images of cow herding in the early discourses. And again, you know, this was really appropriate to the times because people could really relate to cow herding, you know, because that was how many people's lives would be sustained, was through their cows, you know. And I often use the image of the Welsh sheepdogs, you know, who are sent out into these sort of quite wild mountain ranges. And the skill of these sheepdogs is being able to collect and gather the sheep without injuring them, without frightening them, and guide them from pastures that are no longer nourishing into pastures that are now nourishing. So the image that is often used in the discourses has several images of cow herdings, and they're a bit different. So the first of the images that are used is how the cows get very impatient in the last months of the rainy season, and they want to run into the neighbor's ripe field, and the cow herder has to use a certain amount of discipline to keep the cows from foraging into pastures that are ripe and yet not really intended for them. And yet, after the monsoon is over and the fields are harvested and the cows are quite content in their meadows, the cow herder can kind of sit back a little bit, you know. They don't have to use that discipline anymore. They can just occasionally raise their heads to check that the cows are where they need to be, rather than getting lost. So it kind of both portrays a more spacious element of mindfulness and also the discipline element of sati. Another of the images that is used is actually drawn from the metta discourse, the discourse on boundless friendliness, where the Buddha describes metta as a mindfulness, as a sati. And he says in this metaphor that mindfulness is the image of a parent caring for their child, the image of cultivating an affectionate friendliness and the cherishing of all beings. So this really speaks to the attitudinal dimension of mindfulness, of goodwill, of friendliness, of care, of benevolence. The next of the similes that is used is of a person climbing onto an elevated watchtower, top of a mountain, and actually having an overview of the terrain all around them. And this really describes actually the non-preferential nature of mindfulness, that it's not seizing always upon details, or it doesn't have an attentional bias, but it has this overview of everything that is going on within one's experience. Another of the similes that is used is the image of a careful charioteer. I suppose you could put that into contemporary language, a good driver. You know, basically a good driver that actually knows how to kind of stay on the track, that you keep the chariot on the track. It is acutely aware of all of the people and the obstacles in the road. So it describes mindfulness in this sort of circumspect way. It's actually paying attention to detail. It has this kind of spatial awareness within it. Mindfulness is sometimes likened to an elephant's neck, because elephants don't have that much dexterity in their necks, that when they turn to look at something, they often turn their entire body in order to sense something. So it really describes mindfulness as giving a fullness of presence to whatever is being attended to. It's not head up. It includes this whole somatic awareness, this cognitive awareness. It's a fullness of attention. Mindfulness is sometimes likened to being a royal steward in a palace. And the job of the royal steward is to keep reminding the king or the queen of all of their wealth and their riches, their elephants or horses or gold, their property. And this is likened to sati being a quality of remembering about what is precious and valuable to us, about what is good and about what is wholesome and what is effective and worthy. That sati is sometimes described as not floating or slipping away, unlike a gourd that is thrown into a fast-flowing stream that is just carried away by the current. So this really describes the quality of sati as being able to sustain this presence, to keep an attentional focus and not losing the object. Sati is sometimes likened to someone who has very little dust in their eyes, who's not caught in the dust storm, the capacity to see clearly and effectively. Sati is sometimes described as two acrobats working together, one climbing on top of the other up a pole that one is holding, and that both are actually looking after themselves but reliant upon the other to keep a sense of balance. This actually describes a very relational sense of sati, that this is not actually something just cultivated alone, but is actually a relational quality. Those are the similes as far as we can gather them from the early teachings. Does anyone have any questions about any of those similes? Yeah.
Sometimes it seems like they're kind of opposites. Like one might be big overview, and another one might be
very specific. So Brock is just pointing out how, you know, so the images really draw on really all of the different facets of sati, the capacity to have really a sustained, quite detailed attentiveness, or the capacity to have a very spacious awareness. And I think part of the skill of really exploring the landscape of sati is actually knowing what aspect of sati is helpful in any given moment, rather than having a position, you know, that sati is either always this detailed attentiveness or it's just this kind of spacious awareness. To actually recognize that there's a spectrum within sati, and part of the skill of developing it is being able to ask those wisdom questions and what is happening here and what is needed here. I mean, you can see, like, if the mind, it feels very, very scattered and distracted, you know, it's not going to be necessarily that helpful to have a very spacious overview. It might be very helpful to have the image of walking through a crowded marketplace, you know, with a bowl of water and a decapitator behind you, you know, of really needing to actually really pay attention to actually the details and the specifics of the moment. You know, if sati feels too detached, you know, or too dry, we might actually remember the metta quality of sati. You know, but, you know, ultimately, of course, all of these dimensions of sati are meant really to come together in a landscape that we can draw upon as skillful responses, you know, rather than being stuck in a particular view of mindfulness. It's not like we reach a particular goal of mindfulness as being, you know, the best mindfulness is always spacious, you know. Well, the best mindfulness may not always be spacious, you know. The best mindfulness may be appropriate to the moment. So it's actually having, it's almost like a scale, you know. You can think of it as a musical scale, you know, and what kind of note are you playing just now? Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the gatekeeper function of keeping out something that's unwholesome as opposed to aversion?
So the function of the gatekeeper of keeping out something that is unwholesome as opposed to aversion. I mean, the image that is used in the gatekeeper image is the gatekeeper acknowledges the unwelcome visitors. But it's kind of like the difference between offering the unwelcome visitors a glass of water or a five-course meal. You know? You offer the unwelcome visitors a glass of water. You know they're there. You'd like them to be well, but you know that if you give them a five-course meal, they're coming back. So it's bringing in that quality of discernment rather than a protective awareness rather than defensive awareness. And it's very important to know that distinction, I think, in our own practice. Yes.
I've attempted this, but unfortunately I ended up what's he wearing? what image can I use as a gatekeeper? And then what would I, is it the intention, setting empty intentions at the beginning of that gatekeeper offers it? This and this and this.
I mean, the question is about really how to embed the gatekeeper. You know, what is the skillful way to embed the gatekeeper? And if you remember, I said earlier that for many people, the very long time in their practice is really spent in developing both the simple knowing and the protective awareness. And I think that is a recognition that, you know, we have a long history, many people do, of practicing unhelpful psychological and emotional habit patterns. You know, and we don't have such a long history in discerning what is helpful and what is unhelpful. You know, I think we can start to reflect on some of those criteria or some of those questions that I offered earlier. I think those are important questions to almost assimilate and internalize. I don't think it means an over-scrutiny of everything that arises in the sense doors when you're practicing. You know, I don't think it's that kind of defensive awareness that we're kind of analyzing everything that arises. You know, is it helpful or is it unhelpful? You know, is it wholesome, unwholesome? That just becomes very busy. But I do feel that as the practice develops, we do get a very felt sense of what is unhelpful. It's that which is repetitive. And in a way, there's no more insight to be squeezed out of it. You know, it is just repetitive habit patterns. And I think that's when the gatekeeper is often in our ability to actually return and reground our attention in the body and in the present moment recollection, rather than going and analyzing the habit patterns that are arising. And I think as sensitivity grows with mindfulness practice, you know, we really sense the felt impact of the unhelpful and the unwholesome. You know, a pattern of judgment arises, or, you know, a pattern of obsession arises, and we know it, you know? We know it. It doesn't surprise us, it doesn't bewilder us. We know it and we know where it goes. And I think then protective awareness is actually just the fasting metaphor. Let's fast this one. Let's actually feed our capacity to be somatically grounded, you know, to be here, to be present, almost to withdraw the nourishment from that habit pattern. That is the sort of gatekeeper mechanism. Anything more on the similes? Okay, so I want to go on a little bit. To look at actually some of the functions of mindfulness. I think earlier on I named the two primary functions, which is to sever the link between feeling tone, pleasant and unpleasant, and automatic reactivity of craving and aversion. And the other primary function of learning to actually clean up the field of perception. And this doesn't mean that we're somehow stopping perception, because we obviously need navigational perception to function in our lives. And, you know, ethically, perception in itself is quite neutral. It is when perception is actually becomes loaded with emotional memory and imprints and habit patterns that it becomes implicated in creating distress. But there are a number of other effects of mindfulness. It's being aware that the etymology of mindfulness is really of sati is really rooted in to remember, to know how to remember, and you know this very much related to the time of the Buddha when it was and before when teachings were oral, and the way that they were kept alive was through remembering what had been taught. So what the Buddha did is to have this genius of taking this sort of historical translation of sati and turning it into a present moment remembering or a present moment recollection. This is probably the best translation of sati, is a present moment recollection or a present moment collectedness. So it's remembering to be present. Now, that remembering to be present with what is has a number of different effects. The first of these important effects of sati is that it begins to slow inner processes down. You know, when I talked about this cognitive chain, sometimes this happens so quickly that it feels like we're spit out the end without even knowing how we got there. You know, so part of sati is through that attending, the development of simple knowing, the protective awareness of not getting lost, some of these cognitive processes and the reactive processes begin to be slowed down sufficiently that we can actually see what is going on. So that we're not always just spit out the end. We actually begin to see what is going on. Through that simple knowing, as I referred to earlier, we're beginning to make this move from being fully identified with the contents of experience to a place of being able to hold the contents of experience with mindfulness, with kindness, with investigation, rather than with grasping and clinging. And much of that is cultivated actually through this simple knowing. That becomes a vehicle for that. And, you know, if you think about, you know, much of the distress in our life, how much of it is really related to this sense of contractedness and clenching and clinging and identifying and the I am, you know? The I am like this. So really beginning to loosen the grip of that identification. One of the effects of mindfulness is that it tends to illuminate the world of experience. Have you noticed that when you go out in your walking path? You know, that you can go out in your walking path and the mind can be, you know, one moment quite lost just in busyness, just in distractedness or in planning or an obsession. And you come back in and you realize you really haven't been touched by anything at all. And another moment, you can go out in your walking path and mindfulness is really established. And have you noticed how it seems to bring the world to life? You know, you notice the subtleties of the light on the leaves. You know, you hear the birds in the background. You know, you really sense the touch of the air on your skin, and it almost has this effect of illuminating the world. And of course, this is what it does inwardly also. That, you know, this world of experience that often feels kind of shrouded in dullness, or shrouded in confusion or bewilderment, suddenly seems to come to life. What also comes to life, of course, is a sense of capacity, not only bringing to life or visibility that which is unlovely, but that which is lovely. Sati has the effect of removing the bias from our attentional field. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, how much we are prone to really pay attention either to that which shouts at us, you know, with very loud voices, or to pay attention to that which is somehow imperfect or wrong, or, you know, seen to be somehow threatening to us. So we see that often in our own pathway, how much we tend to highlight the presence of the hindrances, you know, the presence of grasping, the presence of selfing, the presence of aversion. We don't tend to notice how many moments in a single day none of this is happening. We don't tend to notice that. In a single day, how many moments that none of this is happening. And the absence of grasping or clinging or aversion doesn't leave a vacuum behind it. You know, these are often moments of sensitivity, they're moments of appreciation, they're moments of empathy, you know, they're moments of kindness, they're moments of spaciousness. And yet how often, because of our attentional bias, we tend to skip over those moments or even doubt them, again on the hunt for something that's not quite right, you know, or something that is identified. So mindfulness is beginning to remove that attentional bias, allowing the visibility not only of the difficult and challenging, but also allowing for the visibility of the lovely. Allowing for the visibility of the lovely. And, you know, for many people in life, this is a whole skill and art to develop. One of the effects of mindfulness is to be able to shift from the world, a world governed by impulse, to a world that is guided by intention. And I always think there's a huge shift for many people to move from a place where our mental states or our moods or our impulses are given authority to actually giving authority to our intentions. The intentions that to have our life guided by intentions that are helpful to us. You know, and that impulsive field can be so strong and so habitual, you know, that to move from that into an intentional life can be really quite radical for many. But that's the feeling of no longer being imprisoned. It's sometimes said that the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intention. And wise intention in Buddhist psychology is not, by the way, is not complex. There's only three. It's a very short list, you know. Kindness, compassion, and non-clinging. I mean, there's many nuances of those three, but kindness, compassion, and non-clinging. To shift from reactivity to responsiveness, and the biggest shift that I ever see anybody make in sati cultivation is actually the shift from aversion to kindness, to that aspect of sati. This is the biggest shift I see anybody making in, you know, contemporary mindfulness-based applications or in more classical retreat situations, to make that attitudinal shift from aversion to a sense of befriending, and a befriending curiosity is, in my mind, the most radical shift anyone makes. It's not easy. Okay, so that's some of the... Oh, no, there's a lot more. Sorry. We begin with mindfulness to distinguish the difference between our story about what is happening and what is actually happening. This is really critical, you know, because we have, you know, the story of my knee, as one of my first teachers said to me, the story of your mother is not your mother. The story of my knee is not my knee. The story I have about you is not you. You know, the story I have about myself is not myself. The story of my illness is not the illness. You know, to begin to actually know the difference between our story about what is happening and what is actually going on. This is quite big, actually. And mindfulness, particularly mindfulness of the body, we begin to read the world of our moods within the body. You know, and again, this challenges one of these kind of splits that is so often made, particularly in, you know, Western culture relatively recently, where mind and body are seen as being separate entities. And instead, there's a shift. In Buddhist psychology, you never hear the phrase mind and body. You see mind / body. So we actually begin to have a sense of embodied moods, both the lovely and the unlovely. The body of sadness. The body of calm. The body of anxiety. The body of spaciousness. We begin to actually move into that more embodied sense of being. And, you know, many of our moods, especially the difficult ones, are much more accessible through the medium of the body than actually through trying to investigate with my thoughts or with my attention a mood. Through the medium of the body, far more accessible. Okay, so that gives you some of a sense of the effects of what mindfulness is actually doing behind the scenes. You know, behind the scenes, what is actually going on as we cultivate this capacity for mindfulness. And it is a capacity that is cultivated, that is brought into being. So any thoughts, any reflections about any of that?
Just a quick comment. I thought that was very powerful, you know, when you said, the story of my mother is not my mother, the story of this pain is not my pain, because essentially that's freedom, right?
Yeah.
The moment of realizing that is just, you know, it's like, oh, house builder, I see you.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is why, you know, mindfulness cultivation is so effective in not only for folks just with, you know, functional neurosis, but with, so effective in the fields of chronic pain and illness and depression, where the level of identification seems to be heightened by the ongoing exposure to the difficult and the painful. You know, to actually see that the story of my pain is not who I am.
I hope this doesn't sound so foolish, but restless leg is something my husband suffers from. And I was wondering about that being embodied anxiety.
Not necessarily.
So I know I'm so weak.
Yeah, I'm always reluctant to pathologize everything.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes restless legs is restless legs. You know, and that's as far as we need to go. And actually how much care and kindness and mindfulness we can bring to that rather than the aversion that so easily builds up around any physical condition that is repetitive and uncomfortable.
So then I guess further to that, what do you mean then about the
Well, that's a classic example you just raised. You know, is this restless legs really a symptom of anxiety, and how am I going to find that anxiety, rather than can I actually bring mindfulness to actually the sensation of this restlessness in the legs? Can I also bring mindfulness to an awareness of coexistence? That actually, as the legs are restless, the touch of my lips together is not.
I didn't hear what you said, though.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't, yeah, I didn't, remind me to repeat the question, sorry. Yeah.
Can you explain that example again, what you meant? So the restless leg is not anxiety? No.
We don't know why it's there.
Right.
We simply don't know. Isn't it? To bring the simple mindfulness to the actuality of the restlessness of the legs, but not also to become preoccupied with that or to make that the sole object of mindfulness. I mean, in actually practicing with any chronic condition, including chronic psychological conditions, I think this cultivation of the awareness of coexistence is really critical in actually being able to have that tower aspect of mindfulness, the elevate, that we have an overview of the entire landscape, and that as the legs are restless, the touch of my lips together is actually not restless, you know? And sometimes the restlessness is eased by the foregrounding, backgrounding of attention, because the restlessness of the legs, for example, in this instance, is the predominant sensation. The attention is drawn to the predominant sensation. What we don't always appreciate is that at times we may make other sensations predominant simply by the attention that we're giving to them. So when the predominant sensation is the restlessness of legs, everything else recedes into the background and that becomes to the foreground. One of the skillful uses of mindfulness is to play with that foregrounding, backgrounding mechanism, so that instead of becoming preoccupied with that predominance, I have, you know, this is one of the great liberations of mindfulness, is to discover that I have the choice of what I attend to and how I attend. You know? So I actually have the choice to actually bring the attention to actually something that is not at all restless. You know? The touch of my lips together. And to foreground that through that attentional field. It doesn't mean that the restlessness disappears, but there's much more of awareness that it is not the entirety of my experience. And you know, that there is a coexistence here. And to be aware of the tendency that exists to seize upon fragments of experience and mistake them to be the whole. Whereas actually no body and no thing can ever be fully defined by seizing upon a fragment. And that's part of reframing cognition. You know, is to not be seizing upon a fragment and mistaking it to be a whole. No one is ever always an anxious person. You know, no one can be described by saying, you know, you're an aversive person. There are probably countless moments in a day when that aversion is not present or the anxiety is not present. So part of mindfulness is expanding that field of awareness to be not hooked into the seizing upon the fragments. And again, this is part of that watchtower simile, you know. It's holding the whole field, rather than seizing upon particulars or fragments.
Yeah. What comes to mind when you were talking about that, say having a problem with your leg and where your attention goes and that, is also when we're in relationship to others and we see whoever it was that might come in late.
Yeah. Sally Jo.
Yeah, I've heard of her. And there's more to Sally Jo than those two instances.
Yeah.
Right, that we might easily miss that, oh, that person was kind to that to that other person or to that animal.
It has huge implications relationally.
Our attention.
Yeah. I mean, probably, have you ever experienced someone saying to you, "I know you"? What is your response to that? Yeah. I mean, we very rarely actually perhaps say that to someone, "I know you." But we can hear the echoes of that in our views, can't we? When someone is actually sort of fixed into being a certain kind of person in relationship to us, in the way how we're saying, "I know you."
Goes the other way, because I've actually said to somebody, "You know me." Now I'm just trying to struggle with, what the hell was I saying?
You know me.
No, it wasn't. It was like, "You know me." They were surprised by something I had done. And so I said, "But you know me. Why does that surprise you?"
Taking maybe the opposite of the restless leg and it's the small piece, to then go into the body to look at what the mood is. Is a skill to develop. And so I think butterflies in the stomach, one that's quite common, I know. Can you mention other examples of heat?
We have, I think, the question is sort of these embodied moods, you know, and how we actually have evolved a whole language, a descriptive language about embodied moods, haven't we? Butterflies in the stomach, you know, hot, seeing red, you know, a chip on my shoulder, you know. We have so many phrases that are really referring to this, the world weighing, you know, the world on my back. You know, we have so many phrases that we've evolved to really describe these embodied moods, you know, and I think there's a skillfulness in that, you know, being able to actually sense how the body is being shaped by moods, you know, and then when the body is shaped by moods without being questioned, how the body then sends messages back to reinforce those moods. So it's really understanding that feedback loop within mind-body process. I mean, you think of a simple example, you know, if I'm beset by dullness, for example, and I collapse, well, the body is actually sending a message back to the dullness, saying, you know, good idea to check out here, you know. So it's an ever-strengthening circle of the actual mood of the moment, you know, and we see this, you know, very simple examples, you know, if you're kind of really anxious and the body is going like this, you know, that very body posture is sending a message back to the anxiety that reinforces it and strengthens it. And it's why actually in Buddhist psychology so much transformation, as I mentioned earlier, is actually behaviorally led. You know, it's why we don't have mattresses in the meditation room. You know, it's why we say, let's try sitting upright. Because actually the body's sending a message actually to the mind here, saying, good idea to be present. You know, good idea to be present. It's why we say, you know, if you're suddenly restless, you know, don't just go running out. Let's actually see what it's like to calm the body, to feel the feet on the ground, to have that sense of groundedness. You know, and so, you know, it's so much within Buddhist psychology. Transformation is behavior-led. It's not always an inside-out process. It's often an outside-in process. It's like I mentioned earlier, even though it's counterintuitive, when you're very restless, be still. Allow that to feed a message back to the restlessness that it can be grounded. You know, as one of my early teachers said to me, if you want to know what generosity feels like, be generous. Which really rather challenges much of the sort of Western ideology around authenticity. You know, that I have to feel like something in order to do it. That's completely counter to Buddhist teaching. I don't have to feel like anything in order to be ethical, in order to be generous, in order to be compassionate, in order to be kind. If I actually really follow through on those intentions, then no matter what is going on inwardly, I'm probably going to get the message, this is actually a more helpful, skillful way to be in this world. You know, and it's not a question of being inauthentic. It's a question about what am I giving authority to? To what I feel like or to the intentions that I know to be the most helpful.